meditation in either a precursor or an early version of the Oxford Graduate Student Christian Forum about 12 years ago. That was on building peace. Now we have war. So I guess that says something about the time. So I come from an international relations background. I have done a lot of work on international security, civil war. I've spent 40 years on the problem of intervention. I was saying to Mark on this point that I agree with John Stuart Mill on the whole, intervention is a bad idea. I can't think of one that went well, and here we are again. I also have a long interest in the meaning of security. I won't detain you on that troubled subject. But what is it? Whose security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of states? Are we talking about the security of communities? Are we talking about the security of people? Or, for that matter, the security of the planet? And that 10-year deliberation, I'm slow, all right? So that 10 years led me to some consideration of the relationship between security and ethics, which is where I want to go today. Specifically, since most of the ethical consideration of war of which we are aware is effectively rooted in Christianity. So, should the UK be bombing ISIS? Should it be bombing Iraq? Should it be bombing Syria? I don't generally, with apologies, I guess this is a sort of confession, I don't do should much. I've been more interested in what and why rather than should. But we'll deal with should today. This is an important ethical and practical question in general for the Middle East and also for the United Kingdom, since the United Kingdom is involved in bombing and drone operations in both Iraq and Syria. So as British citizens, and although I'm Canadian, I'm also British, so I can claim the flag. Don't ask me about my views on the Scottish independence movement, but anyway. We should not ignore this. The topic that I'm addressing also, it seems to me, relates quite directly to Christian belief. Our beliefs, and I think I can speak for myself anyway, and possibly some of you, require us to assess the world in which we live in terms of religious principles which we have inherited and interpreted. And one hopes, although most of us fail, that ethical assessment is the basis for a response to the world in which we live, a Christian response. Now, in what follows, and by the way, I intend to go for about 35 minutes, possibly 40. It really depends on you, because this is interactive. You will help me, or not, to get where I'm trying to go. All right?
I'll begin by interrogating the meaning of the question, should we be bombing ISIS or Iraq or Syria? I'll then spend a little bit of time relating it to just war principles. As I said, they are rooted in a Christian tradition, as is generally the case in how we understand the law of war. I'll then assess the bombings in the, oh my, that's an old term, the Levant. Okay, let's do Iraq and Syria, in practical and ethical terms, and that will, I hope, produce an answer to my question, the should question. Although, I should say that you might convince me that my answer is incorrect or wrong or ethically indefensible, whatever. That's up to you. I stress that this is about bombing. I don't say much about other elements of the UK's engagement in the region, such as military advice, arms transfers, or, in a limited number of cases, boots on the ground, of which there are several hundred, by the way, although that's not generally considered. Now, I'm assuming... interactive question number one. How many of you do war studies, international relations, history of war? Okay, I take that to be nobody. good. because I assumed that this was a non-specialist audience. So I will avoid our disciplinary scholasticism, ontology, epistemology, theory, method, and so on, and because, not least because they don't suit my purpose here. And as I think I've hinted, I will ask you to participate in this endeavor because I want this to be informal and engaging. So, as a start, how many people here believe we should be bombing Iraq and Syria? Don't be shy. I don't raise my hand because I don't think we should, but, and you know, it's a free country. Good grief, I take this to be nobody. Okay. Well, maybe I should stop here. We can go back to
anyway. Maybe this would raise our hands to say we don't think.
Oh, well, there we go. How many don't think we should be doing that? Thank you for that. Okay. So we have a large, how should one put it? Abstention group. There we are. Confused? I'm not sure.
Yes. One point of information. I suspect there are only two Brits here. Three, counting you.
Oh, that's nice of you to say on three. But okay. Well, that is a helpful thing because
Very international.
What I have to say applies also, to my mind, to the U.S. in Iraq and Syria, and until lately, Canada in Iraq and Syria. And actually, Canada, although it has withdrawn its rather small component of an extremely small air force, they remain on the ground in Iraq. Okay, yes, you anticipated my next question, which was how many don't think we should be in Syria and Iraq? Fine. Why do people, those of you who have not abstained, well, actually I could ask why do you abstain on this matter, but those of you who think we should not be bombing Iraq, why do you think that? That would be you in the first instance. That's the one I remember.
Well,
One consideration was that it didn't seem to be an end game that the bombing would lead to, a plausible turnaround or better result at the end of a bombing.
Yes, or in my business, we would add, and it's not obvious what the exit option is. Once you go in, what conditions would produce your going away again? Any other ones? Stuart?
I think it's very difficult to bomb without the amount of what is miserably called collateral damage being enormous. So I always worry about the civilian casualties, the knock-on effects of taking out infrastructure, you know, including destroying electricity plants, destroying water supplies, and so on. So I think bombing, and this is an old argument, going back at least to the Second World War, is a very, very blunt instrument.
Yes.
Except if you're trying to achieve, say, a landing on hostile territory, then it's very difficult to avoid it.
Yes, and of course, this is not just about immediate damage.
No.
It's about damage going forward.
Absolutely.
You know, we could, for example, because ISIS is exploiting oil production in Syria and in Iraq, it would be simple with limited collateral damage, actually, because these oil wells are generally in the desert, to take them all out. Assuming, however, that we solve the ISIS problem, I'm not holding my breath, by the way, however, then Syria and Iraq need to reconstruct again, and we would have destroyed the means to generate the revenue whereby they could rebuild their societies. I'm engaging in opinion here, but your point about infrastructure prefigured my third question at this stage, which is how many people think that the answer to whether we should be doing it depends on what kind of bombing we do. It's one thing to bomb a place like Raqqa, which has a large civilian population and where ISIS is embedded in that population and uses that population as a shield. It's another thing to bomb things in the desert. So perhaps one might say that the answer to the question depends on what the target is. Now, for my take on the question, which is, should we be doing this? In common language, at least in Canadian English, there are two meanings to should. And I intend to argue that this set of operations satisfies neither of those meanings. The first meaning, how many of you like pizza? Okay, good. If I want a pizza, then I should phone Domino's, order a pizza, get it delivered, and pay for it, right? This is a rational choice meaning of should. If a proposed action is consistent with our preferences and the benefits of the action exceed the costs of the action, then we should do it. Right? Otherwise, how do you get the pizza? So, in the case of Iraq and Syria, if bombing conforms to our preferences, if it produces utility from a rational choice perspective, and if the costs and the risks are low or manageable, then we should bomb them. If these conditions are not present or are in doubt, then we shouldn't. So that's the first focus of meaning of the question, and I'll get back to that. There's also a moral and ethical meaning So, in this context, if an action is rightly motivated, and we can be reasonably sure that it will have right effects, then we should do it. And if we can't satisfy those criteria on ethical grounds, we should not do it. So, oh, good grief, there's another question for you. This one, maybe nobody will answer, and whoever does gets a glass of wine at the end. What is right concerning the use of force in armed conflict? What could be right? Ethically. Don't tell me you all believe that nothing could be right. Yes, sir. In the back.
It would be right to use force in defense of direct aggression against your immediate self.
Okay, self-defense. And this is a point about the individual, right?
So, or it could be a group, a specified okay. group, say a boundary okay. of a nation, perhaps, mm-hmm. right?
Okay. So do we all agree that the use of force in self-defense might be right?
No.
Sorry?
No.
Oh, good. Oh, right. Okay. Well, we're going to have a debate. This will never end. Go ahead.
It might be right to defend someone else. I'm not convinced it's right to defend oneself.
Why would you say that?
Because of commands to love one's neighbor, but perhaps. For Christian grounds, not thinking that self-defense is what we're called to.
And then there's also in Scripture turning the other cheek, and you think about the martyrs in the early church who basically went to death because they believed it was wrong to organize their own self-defense. Well, they believed many things. It's a very good point. I will get back to that one, believe me. Anybody else want to tackle this tangled question? If not, I shall proceed. But the third party also comes up.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about, is it right to defend myself? What if, going back to the parables, not least, what if somebody else is at risk? Is it right for us to use force, even if you end up killing somebody, in order to defend somebody else? And what would the rationale for the difference be? Yeah.
I would say that your term of the use, your use of the word at risk is where the crux of that matter lies, right? Because if you're just saying that they're sort of in some sense at risk, therefore you're justified in using action is one thing. Whether they're actually under attack in a say, physical way, that's a whole different thing, right?
Yeah, I have often taught this exact thing, so apologies.
Okay.
Let's say look, I used to hunt, okay? We all have our weaknesses.
And also human.
Well, whatever. But one person's humor is another's whatever, silliness.
Humans. Animals are humans.
Indeed. Let's say you're out in the woods. You're walking through the woods to the edge, and you get to a clearing. And on the other side of the clearing, you see some man, let's say, who has a little child whom he is holding by the neck, and he has a knife in his hand, and you can see the knife beginning to move. Okay. That's a good third-party case. You have a rifle, it has a scope, you have a 95% probability of killing him. Would that be the right thing to do? You raised the third-party question, so you too can
get into.
Well, that's a clear definition of risk. I think in sort of geopolitical terms, we're often talking about risk as in some vague, nebulous thing in the distance.
Absolutely.
Right? Where it's like, oh, there's a risk over there. Maybe they'll show up here one day, so let's bomb them now.
Yeah.
Right? That's a different than the scenario you just painted.
Okay.
Right.
But on that question, does anybody want to tackle it? Who says yes? Shoot him. Please.
Mr. Child is undoubtedly innocent.
Oh. Indeed. I mean, and children. Okay, so let's say this kid is 3 years old, i.e. not fully in possession of consciousness and not conscious of sin and whatever. Yeah. So you would say yes.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody say no? Okay.
I would have difficulty pulling the trigger.
Ah, yes.
In other words, I'd probably prevaricate until it was too late.
Well, that was the reason for the time constraint in the question, right? You know, it's sort of 2 seconds, yes or no. You've got the means, and I know I understand that, but that has something to do with you, not something to do with the situation.
Let's put it the other way around. If this case were to be tried, would we think that the successful shooter had committed a crime? And even if he had committed a crime, do we think there were very strong mitigating factors that would mean that the penalty would not be very large?
And?
I would say I'd be very reluctant to impose a harsh penalty on somebody who shot somebody in that situation, even if it turned out there was some ghastly mistake, like it was a drama group.
It was a game.
it was a drama group and a knife was plastic.
I mean, certainly...
The child was actually a dummy, it wasn't a real child.
Yeah.
It's a funny sort of cross-cultural thing, because now we're getting into the courts if we're talking about imposing penalties. Yeah. In international relations, there are, I'm sorry to say, very few effective established courts. But in that instance, I suspect that in most parts of the United States, anyway, even if you were wrong, I expect that most juries would exculpate you. And in Canada, Mike, that would be most... juries would inculpate you. So it's very difficult water. Yeah.
Because this is really interesting to me, because if you're assuming you're walking through the bush in rural Tennessee, you got one scenario. Are you leading to the point that if there are people in ISIS who are executing little children or stoning women in the public square, that this is our opportunity to pull the trigger if we have a 95% chance? Because I think that's where you're going, but... Is this a parallel that you're trying to draw?
Well, basically, I'm interested in understanding your views on the use of violent force, and if we all believe that this is an extreme action, what makes people cross the line? But clearly, for example, let's leave ISIS aside for the moment and think about Rwanda 1994. We knew that there was a genocide ongoing. We had satellite information on this subject. We knew that through the use of more or less easily deployable air power, we could stop it. We knew if we changed the rules of engagement of the UN Peace Force in Rwanda, they would stop it. They had very restrictive rules of engagement, and they abided by them. And then, of course, what did we do? We decided it was too risky for them, for the peacekeepers. And so we took a 5,000-person peace force down to somewhere between 300 and 500 people, allowing this to continue. So the logical extension of the argument wasn't where I was intending to go, but that's okay. Would be, if we knew we had the capacity to stop that,
And it just required an act of will and an act of conscience in order to do that. And it would have killed quite a number of people. It might even have killed some of the victims, by the way, should we have done that. To my mind, I won't ask at this stage, to my mind, yes, we should have. Absolutely. Yes.
With your case of the small child and the man with the knife, if I were a good marksman and had the capacity in the rifle, what I would prefer to do would to shoot him in the pelvic bones to disable him, and then only deliberately make a fatal shot if, having dropped the child, he then proceeded with the knife to crawl towards the child to continue to kill.
This is a very good point. Another part of my checkered career was in law enforcement, and we were taught you just shoot for the middle of the chest several times, because you can't be sure. You know, you go for something that's not completely disabling, you may not completely disable. But I take your point. Anyway, so you're okay with sort of shooting the guy, but maybe not killing him. Of course, he might bleed to death because it's 5 miles from him. Okay, let's move on. Thank you for that.
Intentions matter.
Absolutely. That is very true. The intention was not present to kill, merely the consequence. Okay. Now, for me, I think that one source of right conduct in human interaction, and by the way, war is a human interaction of sorts, is scriptural. We have the sixth commandment. I won't quiz you on that one. Don't kill anybody. We have the golden rule. You should treat others as you would want to be treated yourself. And I think that the implication of the golden rule is that there's an obligation to help those in trouble. Now, these are Christian principles, but they are not only Christian principles. In the broader secular ethical community and in other religions, this comes down to an ethic of reciprocity. Fine. So we have don't kill people, treat people as you want to be treated yourself, help those in trouble. The problem is we live in a social world, and often those don't flow together terribly well. You know? So the problem lies in the relationship among these ethical principles or religious principles. So, summarizing where we've just been, if someone's trying to kill you, do you have a right to self-defense? That was the first thing. If it means, if, by the way, and this refers to this qualification we just had, if self-defense means killing a person, should you turn the other cheek? What if they're trying to kill your family? Or what if they're attacking a friend? This reminds me of what Jesus said to, somebody will correct me, I think it was Malchus, he said to Peter, after Peter had lopped off the ear of Malchus in the Garden of Gethsemane. My recollection is that Jesus did not approve of this and told Peter to stand down. Should you save a stranger, even if that means taking a life? These are not easy questions, and they certainly weren't easy questions for the early Christians.
Now, once we get to Augustine and the City of God, and by the way, don't worry, I'm not going to go through the next 2,000 years thinking about this subject, all right? We do have a topic here, and I'm getting to it. Augustine proposed that in a sort of modification of the Sixth Commandment, so far as I understand it, that doing nothing in the face of a grave wrong, it was sinful, even if it meant killing. Particularly when this was done in service of what he viewed to be legitimate authority. Now, legitimate authority would evoke another hour and a half on what that means, but we don't need to go there. And besides, I wasn't there when Augustine put that forward. Aquinas clarified further that war could be just. It could be just if it were waged or sanctioned by a legitimate authority, that one again, and if it were in pursuit of a good and just purpose, that's to say, it was not for personal gain or the gain of the state in question. I won't go further. In the evolution of just war theory, most people and most states have arrived at a generally shared meaning of just war. It's divided into two. One is jus ad bellum, which concerns reflection on whether or not to go to war. And the second is jus in bello, concerning conduct in war. The quick summary. Jus ad bellum, just cause, self-defense, or large-scale crimes against humanity. Right intention. I mean, it's not just that the cause is right. Your intent has to be right. You know, you may recall, well, some of you may recall, I recall, that in 2003 in Iraq, the former President Bush decided to invade the country with some help, as it happens, from his British friends and a few others, the Poles and so on. Now, the American decision was initially justified along the way as counterterrorism. It turned out, however, this was indefensible because Saddam Hussein was more threatened by Islamic terrorism than was George W. Bush, and so he didn't have any contacts with international terrorism. And when he did, those contacts were usually fatal for the terrorists. So then Mr. Bush went on to say, oh, it's about control of weapons of mass destruction. That was the problem because the UN put inspectors in there hunting for weapons of mass destruction wherever, under every rock, and behind every, oh no, there were no trees in Iraq. Anyway. And there weren't any of those. So that didn't work. So the last refuge of this man, shall we say, I will avoid the other noun in this context, was we have to defend the Iraqi people. It's our obligation to defend the Iraqi people against this brutal regime. No doubt it was. Off he went. The real intention, however, is obscure to this day. And I won't ask the question, why did the U.S. really do Iraq? Because it is, unfortunately, an imponderable. You can talk about oil, you can talk about the fact that Saddam Hussein tried to assassinate Bush's father, you can talk about American status as a hegemon, you can talk about Trump wanting to try out new weapons. None is sufficient, and also the empirical basis is undiscoverable until the year 2033, when we shall know at least what they were really thinking.
So to go on with Ius ad Bellum, in this theory of the law of war, war is a last resort. You try everything else, negotiation, sort of wine and cheese parties, and so on and so forth, and if nothing else happens, then it's a last resort. A fourth is right authority. Who is allowed to authorize the use of force against another state? The UN Charter is very clear. If it's self-defense, you can act in self-defense, pending authorization by the UN Security Council. If it is an act other than self-defense, it has to be approved by the UN Security Council. And finally, and this is important, I will get back to this. How am I doing for time? I guess I started at 7:35, and so we're now at 8:18 or so, or 8:15. So we're coming to the end. I will get to, by the way, the case that we're talking about soon. The last one concerning Ius ad Bellum, law of war, is that people who do this need to have a reasonable prospect of success. That's to say that people who engage in war in just war terms need to be reasonably convinced that they can achieve the objective in a manner where the costs, i.e. the human costs, do not exceed the benefits. This reminds me of my favorite American general. This would have been Curtis LeMay, who was in charge of the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam War, who once remarked, in his case, I don't think it was ironic, that, well, we had to destroy Vietnam in order to save it, i.e., costs exceeded any possible benefit, and this was, in this view, unjust. Now, on law in war, the means deployed have to be proportional to the objectives intended. Okay, so if you want to change the government of Iraq, you can't use hydrogen bombs on Iraq. Okay, that would be disproportionate. And also, there's the principle of discrimination. That's to say, war involves combatants. And so, we all have an obligation, when we engage in it, to avoid, in as much as possible, damage to civilians. This goes back to Stuart's point a while ago. Okay, so, now, we have two different metrics on which to assess whether we should be bombing these places. We have a so-called rational choice utilitarian perspective, cost, benefits, risks. And we have a normative one. What's right in our instance in religious terms? Let's apply this to the case before us, which is going after ISIL or Daesh or IS. I preferred ISIS myself. Reminded me of my rowing days. We've got two different ways to look at this question. Let's start with the interest-based utilitarian account. That's to say, if a proposed action is consistent with our preferences, our utility, and the benefits of the action exceed the costs, then we should do it. It's a matter of course. That's what states do in an anarchical, pluralistic, threat-based system in international relations. So, what interests, this is a question for you all, what interests might underlie our intervention in these conflicts? I'll be creative. I mean, I don't want to conclude that you think we have no interest basis for what we do.
That would be deeply disturbing. It would remind me of our current debate on Europe, by the way. leaving that aside. Okay, I'll give the quick and dirty on this one. Containing terrorism, right? We want to, as Winston Churchill put it once with regard to the Bolshevik takeover of Russia, we need to, it's a mixed metaphor, I apologize, we need to strangle the viper in its cradle. maybe if we sorted out Iraq, we would solve the migration problem. There's another one. Maybe we should support democracy, because as we know, democracy, as is amply demonstrated, not least by the United States, democratic governance produces peace. Sorry, that was editorializing. We might have had benefits in terms of alliance cohesion and alliance solidarity. We should do it because we rely on the United States and they're in there. And so, because we value that relationship, we should go along. This is, as the French would say, this is the Tony Blair as poodle interpretation of our engagement in the last war. Okay, so we have a constellation of interests here. By the way, I'm beginning to worry. I spent half the afternoon in a meeting on the government's prevent strategy, and I'm beginning to wonder whether you're going to report me. Does anybody know about this? No. It's not good. I'm supposed to report you, so I suppose reciprocity being what it is, you should report. we're done with interests. What about risks and potential costs? So we go there. What risks do we bear when we do that? Well, there's the obviously we're going to spend a lot of money. We are spending a lot of money. Not as much as we did in the first time. One possibility is that if we make life too difficult for ISIS, Daesh, whatever, in Iraq, they will move. I'll get back to that. A second is that, and as they move, they might destabilize other places, whatever. A second is that our actions against them might exacerbate the threat we face from terrorism perpetrated by them. Third is migration. And fourth is we have one side in this conflict, and other people might have other sides in this conflict. So if we push down in terms of stabilizing Iraq, we might get counter-intervention by others. All of these are plausible in theory, and one might say actual in practice. So, and my next question to you, but you're obviously getting tired, so we should come go to an end. What about the nature of our involvement? We have decided that we shall, and we do, engage in direct aerial combat. We have decided that we will not directly engage, at least regular forces, in combat on the ground. One could argue about this, and I have a few things to say about this, but I guess the real question would be, does what we have limited ourselves to doing make a difference to the course of the war? Well, in Iraq, I actually did sort of updating research on this today. In Iraq, we have on average about 8 to 12 aircraft active.
plus a movable number of drones and reapers. We direct their fire mainly at combat forces of IS, either through direct attack on them or by providing aerial support of Kurdish forces in Iraq. As of the 5th of February 2015, Britain accounts for 6% of coalition airstrikes in Iraq, a number which the Commons Select Committee on Defense terms modest. 6% sounds pretty modest to me. In Syria, we have up to 12 aircraft engaged in surveillance, air support, and attack on ISIS targets. So far as one can tell, they have implemented since mid-December when Parliament, in its wisdom, decided to prevent the extension of the air campaign to Syria, they have implemented 4 airstrikes. Now, in terms of the rational cost-benefit calculation, if the objective is to destroy the terrorist threat, there is no evidence that our actions actually contribute to the, significantly to the destruction of the terrorist threat. If the objective in Syria is to support the opposition in the effort to overthrow Assad, then again, there's no evidence of success there. In fact, one could make a decent argument to the contrary. If the objective was to maintain our solidarity in alliance terms, then no doubt the United States was happy to have us aboard. On the other hand, allies who said no incurred no political costs, no economic costs in their relationship with the United States, so that zeroes out. And, as I mentioned earlier, Canada, under its previous rather interesting government, decided to participate with, I think, 4 aircraft. And then the current, also rather interesting government, decided to pull them out. And Canada has faced no costs in its alliance relationship. In fact, Obama and Justin Trudeau had a conversation, and Obama said, yeah, I understand, yeah, that's fine. You know, we don't want to be there either. Anyway. What about costs and risks in this rational calculus? And then I'm going to go to the moral should to conclude. Well, to go to the exit option and how once in, what are you doing, how do you achieve the outcome that you desire, I think we face a serious problem of disentangling the UK from the overall operation because there is no exit option. I can't really comment on how much this is costing in economic terms because no data are available on the subject. But it is expensive to maintain large numbers of people in a place like that. The government claims that there have been no, going back to your question, sir, there have been no civilian casualties from UK air operations in Iraq or in Syria. But they have not divulged their methodology or their intelligence for arriving at that conclusion. And the political advantages of saying that are obvious. So I'll zero that one out. Now, in terms of risk, we get to negative unintended consequences. When we started this campaign, Islamic State
was operating in Iraq and Syria. Now, Islamic State is operating in Iraq and Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya. This strikes me as a sort of one consequence of what the coalition is doing there is, it's like squishing a balloon. It's here, and it expands at the sides. It's exactly the problem that the Russians had in the Chechen War in the 1990s and 2000s. So I hesitate to use a medical metaphor with a doctor present, but it's metastasis. You know, if we see this as a cancerous growth, you try to deal with it here, and it bounces all over the place. Those who want to see a literary manifestation of that, I recommend Solzhenitsyn's The First Circle. It is clear that, in general, the to me anyway, the prolongation of the actions of the UK, the US, and others has prolonged the war in Syria. This is not an argument for Assad victory. It's just the fact that we've given the opposition enough to keep in the game without giving them the opportunity to succeed. And that kills people. It kills civilians. And finally, another unintended consequence of the operation as a whole and the stasis, the incapacity to arrive at a conclusion, has been instrumental in producing about one-third of the migration crisis that Europe now faces. And as we saw in Paris, I'm sorry to say, since we have no proper control over informal migration, you get victims, but you also get perpetrators. So, and they then perpetrate. So it leads to two further questions, the lingering questions. Can you win without ground forces? I suspect not. Would it be worth it to insert ground forces? I suspect not, because societies react badly to foreigners trying to determine their futures by killing a fair portion of their population. I don't know. Goes back to what I said at the beginning, which is I have an inherent suspicion of interventionism, because it's very hard to be sure you understand the situation to the extent that you can be confident about producing positive results, and that leads to the how do you get out question. So, the moral should, and I'll trot through this reasonably quickly. Let's leave aside, just for the sake of argument, you may contest it, let's leave aside the question of whether intervention in civil conflict can ever be moral. There's a rather large debate about that. And turn instead to the criteria that I discussed earlier with regard to the moral should. Just cause. Defense or prevention, defense against or prevention of mass violation of humanitarian law. It's not clear that what we're doing has any effect on that at all. I mean, ISIS continues to do what it does. The Iraqi government, by the way, our ally, also continues to do what it does. The Syrian government continues to do what it does. And what we do has no effect on the humanitarian logic of the conflict. So, in fact, it might make it worse. There's been no effect of massive violation of human rights. So much for just cause. Just intent. That's to say, we're doing this for the good of humanity rather than for our own good. Okay. In terms of destroying IS, if we ever achieve that, I think that, by and large, would be a good thing. Per se. On the other hand, our If indeed we went there because the U.S. wanted us to go there, that is self-interested and does not satisfy the moral criteria. As for last resort, which, you know, it's, you know, intervention and use of force after other alternatives have been exhausted, yeah, well, there are no other alternatives, so I think we meet it on the last resort criterion. Right authority, we clearly do not, because this was not authorized by any right authority other than, in our case, I guess, what is that man's name? Ah, David Cameron. And the Parliament. Yes, I won't go get into parliamentary expenses scandals. But anyway. Reasonable prospect of success. I see no reasonable prospect of success. In fact, our action, as I argued earlier, has spread the conflict rather than eliminating it. As it becomes harder for ISIS to operate in Iraq, they operate in other places to our detriment. Are the means proportional? I suppose. On discrimination in war, i.e. making sure you don't hit non-combatants, we claim zero casualties, but we don't know. Civilian casualties, but we don't know. I didn't mention the ethic of prudence, which is, by the way, my favorite ethic. but I will now. I mean, learning from history. We went to Iraq in 2003. We created Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We then suppressed them. They moved to Syria. They created the Islamic State, which is the threat we're facing now. Take Afghanistan as another example. We intervened in Afghanistan with the United States and a broad coalition. That intervention failed to stabilize Afghanistan, and our chosen proxies are now losing to the people we thought we had dealt with. And by the way, in Iraq, sorry to bounce around, we produced a failed state. So, conclusion. I'm trying to find an optimistic thing to say. I really am, but I'm having trouble. You can help me out. As for me personally, I have no problem with military operations so long as they make sense in utilitarian terms and in terms of a strict interpretation of just war theory and the ethics of war. These operations do not satisfy those criteria for me. On balance, therefore, we should not be involved in these campaigns. They don't produce utilitarian benefits, to go to should number one. They carry significant costs and risks. It's not clear what the exit strategy is. In terms of the moral meaning of should, they fail on the reasonable prospect of success and they lack proper authority. They may fail on the just intention criterion and on the discrimination criterion. And they fail on the principle of prudence. Conclusion. Somewhat to my distress, I find myself on the Jeremy Corbyn side of this issue, if not on many others. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, Q&A, welcome. I don't know how long we have.
We have roughly 15 minutes.
Great.
And then and it's already been interactive, so that's great. And yeah, we'll just keep it going for another 15, and then possibly a little bit more after with wine.
Sure.
I have Quaker origins, so I waver between pacifism and a very strict adherence to just war. But if you look back at history, just war has... It's been the exception where just war principles have been rigorously followed, even by states and people groups professing to be Christian. I mean, think of the 30 Years' War in much of
Indeed.
Europe, for instance. You know, everybody making it worse, vicious intercommunal conflicts, disaster for almost everybody. There was, where was justice in that? So, I worry whether just war theory is so idealistic that it doesn't intersect with, almost doesn't intersect with. Give me an example where just war principles were followed historically.
Well, a pure example is difficult because it always gets ragged at the edges.
A tolerable example.
Okay, major conflicts of the 20th century. World War I, no.
Because it was disproportionate to the issues involved.
And also it involves substantial indiscriminate use of force.
Yeah.
Well, disproportionate, yeah, absolutely. World War II, that would be the... probably the standard 20th century example of a just war because of what? Of genocide. Because of mass displacement of civilians, because of atrocities committed in action. And also, I mean, on the jus ad bellum side, I do believe that was just. Jus in bello gets very complicated because, of course, we were not immune to the abuse of civilians. By the way, I include our Soviet allies who marched their way through Eastern Europe at the end of the war, displacing millions of people and abusing millions of women. I don't think there has ever been, at least not in modern history, a purely just war. It becomes a rather relativistic and uncomfortable and untidy judgment involving counterfactuals, not least. So you take World War II with all of its... imperfections on our side, and you think about the counterfactual of not having done that, and then you weigh the difference, and on balance, you know, I think we would all, despite the damage, I think we would all, well, many of us wouldn't be here as it happens, but I think not having done that would have been regrettable in moral terms. Go ahead, yeah, in the back.
So my question is, I mean, do the Swiss sit around and lament the fact that they didn't attack anyone and they simply stayed in their Swiss Alps through us? Like, I mean, it seems to me that there's an option here that it's not being considered.
No.
Or do they?
They took a ton of money from the Nazis and made lots of money out of
them. Well, there's an option as well.
Well, there we are.
But, I mean, do they sit around? I guess you always have the option of being strong and not involved, do you not? I mean,
yes.
Like they did.
Yes. Have you ever read, you must have read Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. There's a famous, well, to me anyway, because I'm fascinated by such things. There's a famous passage where I think Gandalf or whoever tries to convince the dwarves to participate in the campaign against Mordor.
Yeah.
And the dwarves look at him and they say, why would we do that? The dwarves are for the dwarves. Now, I hope there's nobody Swiss here. But, you know, there's something to that. And by the way, the Swiss are historically, in the long history, The Swiss provided lots of military power for rent in Europe in the 15th through the 17th century. These pike companies, who were very professional, they knew exactly how to do it. And why do we have Swiss guards in the Vatican? It's a hangover from when essentially the Vatican rented Swiss pikemen to protect them in whatever century it was. So I think they have a more checkered record than we would like to believe, and that includes, by the way, the gold issue in World War II. But is there an option? What would that option be, say, for the UK?
Well, you already have a really big moat, which we don't have in Canada, for example.
This is true.
Right? So your an option would be to simply, deal with what you have here, and that the government would focus on the people who are here and taking care of the people who are already here and making sure that none of that chaos and dystopia that's out in the rest of the world, which always has been and probably always will be, makes it here. I'm just, as a foreigner, looking at this, seems to be fairly straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I mean, but first of all, it is very hard to ensure that the dystopia doesn't make it here. Secondly, this is almost Cameron-esque, which, having been on the Corbyn end of things, I'll go that way. Whatever. If you will, in IR theory terms, if you just defect from the world, that has a demonstration effect. I mean, I've been thinking about this in terms of Brexit. Brexit, British exit, there we are, for those of you who are not following this rather exotic flower of British politics. I've been listening to the debate. They say, what does the EU do for us? And some people say it does a lot for us. And other people say, we lose, and therefore we should get out. And I look at this and I think, one thing that is not present in the debate is, what would our exit do to Europe? I mean, there are lots of others who might decide to depart. You can depart in two ways. You could fall off the edges, so that would be Hungary, say, which doesn't really like much of what the EU is doing anyway, and seems to like Putin, interestingly. It's nice that somebody does. And then you can defect the other way. So Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, creating a hard core and basically saying, okay, you don't like the plan? Fine, do what you want. My point there is we have, to my mind, since we benefit from this arrangement, to my mind, we have an obligation of solidarity to the others who are our partners. And also, we have a long history of getting extremely, painfully engaged in a dysfunctional Europe. We are, I guess, about a month away from the 100th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. That's an exquisite illustration of the cost of meltdown out in dystopia. And we can't, in a situation like that, it was impossible to stay away from it. And we got, you think about the impact of World War I on Britain. We have benefited for 70 years from comparative calm in our European neighborhood. For much of that period, it was underwritten by the United States. The United States is not underwriting anymore much. And so we need to think carefully about that. So, I mean, the general point in terms of just
I don't know, digging the ditch deeper or building the wall higher is it doesn't, you know, it's hard to do. Leaving aside the fact that 35% of our GDP is accounted for by international finance. So I don't think that option is available. But hey, you know, hey. It may be available for Canada, I don't know.
Well, no, I think it's certainly... I mean, you're talking about the flow of capital versus the flow of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, there's a distinction there to be made, I think, right?
So. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. And
The problem is that the flow of capital is an extremely powerful factor. You know, I'm just retired, but the big factor underlying British politics all my life has been the fact that we're dependent on external capital, and therefore, until very recently, interest rates have to be set to attract the inflow of money, and that's a very, very strong control on the political activity of a country.
Mm-hmm. And we benefit in this context from the single market financially, a Big Bang effect. And if we departed all of that, we would have problems in sustaining our position.
Can I try to move us back to
we have a question here, Stuart.
Oh, it sort of follows on the first question. You said, despite your strong reservations about intervention, that you do think intervention should have been implemented in Rwanda. So just wondering if you could clarify what a situation in which intervention is clearly called for looks like, either in Rwanda or in hypothetical future cases.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And this is going to be a terrible answer. The thing about Rwanda, and I know the commander of the UN force in place personally, a rather damaged senior Canadian general who had to watch it happen without being able to do anything about it. And he said, you know, if one, this is modest, okay? It's not, you wouldn't even need it to bomb the place. If the mandate had been changed to allow the UN force to actually protect civilians at risk and to use force other than in self-defense, and if the force complement had remained what it was or had been increased, let's say, by another 5,000, that could have been cleaned up in a week. And you would have 600,000 dead people alive. And there are no large international implications. The unintended consequences, I think you could predict, could have been containable. It was a little thing which caused a lot of death. And morally, it would have been the right thing to do, it seems to me. And we just, I mean, why did that happen specifically? In the UN Security Council, when they were considering this issue in 2004, the United States, in particular, was just finishing its retrospective review on peacekeeping in the context of the Somalia operation 1992-94, when they lost some people and it went really badly. And they decided this was just a bad idea. So they weren't willing to support. They wanted to see the UN basically out of Rwanda. And you got about 9/10 of the way there when you ended up with about 500 UN people sitting around. They saved a lot of you Rwandans, but not the majority. That one, containable, low force, obvious effect, more or less easy exit. Proportional, discriminate, quite right intention. Frankly, not many people other than the French really cared about what happened to Rwanda anyway. I mean, in terms of national interest, it fits all criteria. We didn't do it. So we get involved in situations where the criteria are not fulfilled, and we avoid situations where they are fulfilled. But... Sorry.
Neil, I think there's another factor in Aranda, which is, according to people I knew, people who are knowledgeable about Central Africa have been worried about this area descending into anarchy for a long time. So I would draw a moral that it's always worth listening to people with deep local knowledge. And that, I think that's one thing that went wrong in Iraq, etc.
Yes.
There was heavy advice from professional civil servants, academics, and so on, that the second conflict was a can of worms from the beginning.
Yes, well, there's a wonderful anecdote, which, unlike most anecdotes, happens to be true. Concerning the American operation in 2003, where the State Department in early 2002 had been tasked with rehabilitation and reconstruction and state building in Iraq post-invasion. This is a year before the invasion. And as bureaucracies do, they produced reams of paper on how to do this and who was going to do what and where and so on and so forth, where the water supplies were, how to maintain the electricity and all this stuff, and you know, keeping on civil servants who actually knew how to do the job and so on and so forth. And I think it was about a month before the invasion, an invasion which, by the way, violated international law, but let's not get picky, responsibility was transferred from the State Department to the Defense Department. The 1,000-page plan was sort of shredded. And the Defense Department and this crazy guy...
Rumsfeld.
That was one crazy guy. You know, stuff happens. And then Paul Bremer, the person designated in the operation to run Iraq. They didn't mean run Iraq into the ground, but that's what he did. And so they went in with no plan. They dumped all of the existing civil service because of debathification. And they didn't actually have plans or maps of infrastructure and so on. They had no idea what was going on around them. And they also believed in the early days that there was no mission objective to protect infrastructure, cultural objects. You remember the looting of the Iraqi National Museum. It wasn't in the mission statement. So there we are. Sorry.
I've
we're coming to the end of our time. We'll let you get away with us, Stuart.
On a very positive note, I know you to have been involved in mediation in some very difficult conflicts. Could you just say a tiny bit about why you do that?
In closing, which gives you a chance to end on a
positive note. Well, in respect of the mediations in which I have been tangentially involved, the results are generally not positive. But the reasons why you do that...
But you tried, right?
The reasons why you do that are clear. This has to do with... I think inasmuch as we have an obligation, which I think we do, to try to mitigate the consequences of conflict, the best mitigation is prevention. And if you're in, and so pre-conflict mediation of political disputes makes sense in terms of the human consequences of not preventing. And mediation in conflict makes sense. I mean, you've already lost a lot of ground, but if you don't stop it, or at least suspend it, one, the damage continues and worsens, and two, there is no space for a meaningful conversation about how to resolve. Yeah. And we know, I mean, the consequences of failure to try are not happy ones, generally. These things will flow to the point of exhaustion, and then you can start over. But that's a very costly process, costly in human lives. And also, I think it's a violation of personal ethical commitments to let it happen. So, remember the book of Job.
Well, thank you very much for that. I mean, we had sort of positive note. The book of Job is...
it's great stuff. You know?
Well, it's good stuff. It is good stuff.
I used to read it to my kids.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. An extraordinarily fascinating conversation. And perhaps if there's a bit more time with wine afterwards,
sure.
Although if you have to be off, that's fine too. But let's just thank Professor Neil McFarlane for this.